Welcome to Greater European Talks, the official podcast of the Institute for Greater Europe. My name is Adit Srinivasan, and I'll be your host for this mini-series on the politics of time and temporality, tentatively titled Talking About Time, Discourses on Temporality and Its Discontents. In the short collection of episodes, we'll be exploring a growing camp in the study of politics and IR, dedicated to the study of time and temporality in global politics. Each episode is modeled after a roundtable format, wherein I've invited 2 to 3 experts in the field to speak to their research and insights on the political value of time. Joining me in this third installment of the series is Professor Edelstein, David Edelstein, Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University, an expert and a prolific author on great power politics, and the author of Occupational Hazards, Success and Failure in Military Occupation, as well as Over the Horizon, Time, Uncertainty, and the Rise of Great Powers. Thanks for joining us, Professor Edelstein.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Next, we have Professor Ryan Beasley, Deputy Head of School of International Relations at the University of St. Andrews, a political psychologist and foreign policy theorist with an interest in decision-making processes, and the author of Foreign Policy in Comparative Perspective, Domestic and International Influences on State Behavior. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks a lot.
So to go ahead and get this party started off right, I thought we'd kind of explore for those unfamiliar with time and temporality studies, just why time at all? It feels like for most students of politics and IR more generally, time is just the fourth dimension. It's a ticking clock. It's that ever so annoying morning alarm. It's something that just is so kind of ubiquitous in our daily lives, but maybe the political value gets overlooked quite often and maybe even kind of outright ignored. So I'd like to go ahead and start off the discussion with just why time. And if we could start with Professor Edelstein, as you've written quite frequently in your work on the merits of temporality studies in shaping our understandings of, I think, one of the biggest puzzles of politics in IR, and that's just great power politics. So to those who may be unfamiliar with temporal studies, why is it that time is such a unique object of analysis?
Yeah, thanks for the question. And I think it's a great place to start this discussion. And as I think about it, you almost answered this in passing in your question, right? You mentioned time as the fourth dimension, right? Which is a very kind of conventional way that people sometimes think about and conceive of time. And as I started to kind of think about time and understand time, it became apparent to me that if you look at just about any major work of international relations theory, time is often kind of latent in the background as something under-theorized or not theorized at all. Yet, if you start to look at the kind of temporal assumptions that are being made in the argument, they have great consequences for the argument and its implications, right? And so for me, this journey to kind of think about time and its role in international politics started with that realization that we would do well to be much more explicit about the role that time is playing in our arguments. And in fact, that if we were explicit, we would be able to develop kind of novel arguments that led to different expectations about the nature of international politics by taking time seriously.
No, that sounds brilliant. I think that really came through in this most recent work of yours, Over the Horizon. If we could turn to Professor Beasley here, in your work, you explore the role and function of temporality in specifically in foreign policy decision making. And I think that's such a central development to global affairs. So I wonder here, just the same question, why is it that time is worth putting under the microscope?
Well, at the risk of offering a very similar answer, one of the things that brought me to the study of time was working with Andrew Hom, who is a critical IR time theorist. And if your listeners don't know exactly what that means, that's okay, because I'm still not sure exactly what it means. But he takes a critical approach, like questions the basic assumptions about the nature of time. And in my conversations with him, it became clear that there really was a broad set of common assumptions about what time was, and therefore why it would have certain effects on decision making or anything that's a process that happens, transpires over time. The fact that it's so commonly understood is a very reason to take it out and examine it a little bit more closely, because we probably have a lot of assumptions that are driving us forward. So that's sort of the basis of my investigating time, was just the realization that we assumed what time was, but very rarely did we actually study the nature of time. And it is ubiquitous, as you said. You even used the word ubiquitous in your setup on the question. And we all have common knowledge of it. We all deal with it every day. Every person listening to the podcast, every person that we know is dealing with time, and therefore they think they know what time is. But it's actually kind of poorly understood. And so I think that that's an avenue for saying this is an important thing to investigate further more systematically. Yeah.
You both mentioned there ubiquity, and something I've really found really fascinating about the ubiquity of the concept of time is that surely that lends a little bit of complexity to the problem of actually going about studying it, since it feels like at any given time, quote unquote, there's any number of temporalities and conceptions of the idea of time that are always at play. So I think maybe we could segue into the practicals of time studies. I don't know if that's the right word, where we look into what it actually means to study time. And here, if it's all right, I'll start again here with Professor Beasley. You mentioned Andy Hum, who we also had the opportunity to host in this miniseries. You wrote an article in March 2021, where you discussed the various conceptions of time that were deployed by British leadership in Westminster over the course of the development of Brexit and the concomitant national strategy. And I think one of the really interesting claims of the article is that different agents and actors in foreign policy decision-making form unique relationships with time. So I wonder here, what exactly does that mean for those who might be unfamiliar with that sort of critical language? And are there any examples that come to mind of what this looks like in practice?
Well, hold on to your hats for a second, because I've got to kind of tell you how we conceive of time differently. And I'll try to be brief with that, but it's important in order to allow agents to be able to manipulate time or to think of them as manipulating time. So the traditional approach to time is kind of a linear one. And it's not wrong. It's just the traditional approach. There's a past, there's a present, there's a future. We're traveling along a line through time, and that we might look way forward in time. Of course, Professor Edelstein's work is exactly looking at the time horizons and looking at the impact of different time horizons for people. But it lines up. It's on a line, essentially. Whereas Andy Hum and I developed a foreign policy timing theory that says, if you think about time differently, if you think about it as a set of relative changes, something here is changing on one hand and something over there is changing on the other hand, and we're actually kind of thinking about the relationship between these different changes. If you time a runner with a stopwatch, you're really saying, how much does the runner change location versus how much does the stopwatch hand change location? And if you think about it as relative changes, then you begin to think about the synchronization aspect of timing as a verb. This is timed with that. One thing is timed with another thing. And then you can say, aha, I could actually time two things so that they're coordinated with one another. And that begins to think about time as something that you can construct and create. And once you say that, then you begin to say, well, what all can be coordinated? What's possible to coordinate? So you ask for an example. In the Brexit case, one of the things that was actively manipulated was, where was the locus of decision-making going to be? Was it going to be with the prime minister and the cabinet, or was it going to be in the parliament? And that meant they were trying to coordinate how decision-making would keep pace with external events that were happening in the Brexit case. That battle, you can think of as a battle over the timing of control over Brexit. And so if you reconceive time from a linear conception to a coordination conception, then you can begin to see some actors are trying to build a new timing system. They're entrepreneurs. Some are trying to subvert an existing timing system. They're malcontents. And others are just trying to make things run as smoothly as possible. And they're apparatchiks, timing apparatchiks. I don't know if that's exactly responsive, and there are probably a lot of questions that you might generate from that, but.
No, absolutely. No, that's very helpful though. And if we could hold on to that thought, because I do have a follow-up about this, but for now we'll turn to Professor Edelstein in your work, the most recent one, Over the Horizon. The idea of hegemonic competition is ubiquitous in IR. It's one of the first things that I think students of politics in IR are introduced to, which is this idea of great power politics. What you do in your book is you introduce the kind of temporal aspect of great power politics, and you argue that the nature of great power politics kind of reduces to this breakdown in the way in which leaders of a rising or hegemonic power frame costs in terms of long-term, short-term, present-day, et cetera. So could you elaborate a little bit on that and in terms of what temporality has to offer for that sort of debate?
Yeah, thanks. And I would just preface this by saying, before I launch into my answer, that I think one of the really interesting and kind of fascinating things about this temporal turn in the study of international politics is you have people coming at it from all sorts of different directions and instincts and kind of epistemological priors, right? So I am not a critical theorist, right? I very much have appreciated reading much of the kind of critical work that is being done on time, but it's not my particular approach, right? And not how I look at these questions. But there's nothing wrong with that, right? In fact, I think that kind of makes this a very bright, vibrant way of studying international politics, precisely because people are coming at this same concept from lots of different directions, right? And so I mentioned that because, you know, I would, to frame it, I would adopt a what, you know, would be a much more kind of conventional sort of kind of positivist way of thinking about this, right? In the sense that I would go back to one of your earlier comments about time and its constancy in a sense, right? We all deal with time on a daily basis, right? And we all knew the time that we were supposed to be here for this, right? We all have time around us all the time. And one of the things that we often talk about in social science in general, right, is you can't explain change with a constant, right? So if you conceive of time as a constant, right, then it's not going to get you very far, right? Because we can't understand the types of variation that we're interested in explaining international politics. So as I kind of, my sort of lens into this, right, was to think about, well, time in some sense might be a constant, but the ways in which political actors understand time and the way that they make their decisions relative to time may vary in important and consequential ways, right? And so what I do in Over the Horizon in the book is look at the precisely these different time horizons, right? The kind of, you know, conventionally we think of it as kind of short versus long, right? The horizon over which political leaders are making decisions and valuing sort of things in the short term versus the long term. And under what conditions are they more likely to value things that are long term? And under what conditions are they more likely to value short term, right? And so my argument in that book is that we can understand patterns of cooperation and competition between existing great powers and rising great powers based on the interaction of these time horizons that they have. And for me, what's important about the book and what I hope is novel about the book is that I think by recognizing that temporal dimension, by recognizing those time horizons, we can account for variation in the relationship between those powers that other arguments don't explain for us, right? That kind of leave us short and leave us puzzled about certain types of behavior that we see. And so for me, the real value added is to say, okay, by recognizing that fourth dimension, seen through this lens of time horizons, we can explain things that we weren't able to explain with other existing theories.
You mentioned just then the idea of positivism and maybe adopting a more positivist approach in your book. And something I think is really interesting about this particular panel, Professors Peasley and Edelstein here, is that we have both of you look at time in that way, in a very kind of more conventional positivist approach, which attributes some causality, explanatory value to different conceptions of time in the development of politics. We've had the opportunity to introduce, to discuss critical theorists in this short mini-series, Professor Andy Holm being an example, Professor Cohen, Elizabeth Cohen. And something I think is really interesting about your work is that introducing that causal dimension to this idea of time, just so ubiquitous. One question that arose in other episodes, I'd like to go ahead and ask you two here, is how exactly we go about doing that. Obviously, it's quite a difficult concept to get a track of. And something that I think is fascinating about the idea of time is that it seems like intentionality is a concept that it's hard to get a hold of. And what I mean by that is both of you have talked about how different political leaders and actors, agents employ different ideas of time in the development of political affairs. But to what degree do you think that that's intentional? Is it that a political leader is going into a situation thinking these are the goals and this is the strategy and it just so happens that that's a manipulation of time? Or is time and the ideas of reframing costs using different time horizons an intentional strategic choice? I'll start here with Professor Edelstein, if that's okay.
Yeah, it's okay. I will say this is you're making me kind of shiver and shudder, right? Because you're bringing me back to some real struggles that I had in writing my book and thinking about precisely these questions. So I decide that I'm going to write a book on time horizons and the way that time horizons impact the political decisions that leaders make. The first question then that somebody with my kind of positivist inclinations is going to sort of ask myself is, okay, how do I go out and measure time horizons, right? And lo and behold, that turns out to be a really difficult thing to do. And not only is it a difficult thing to do, but as I started kind of talking to my colleagues and, you know, my inner circle of people who I bounce ideas off of, I started getting the pushback from some of them of what makes you so sure that this thing you're calling time horizons actually exists in any meaningful way, right? Well, that was a stumper, right? You know, and kind of set me back for a while to kind of think about that. So ideally wants a kind of measure of time horizons that is independent of the political decisions that a leader is making, right? You don't want to say they made a long-term oriented decision, therefore their time horizons are long, right? That kind of is a circularity that isn't particularly helpful. So, you know, I kind of spent a lot of time trying to think about, are there ways in which we could assess the time horizons independent of those decisions, right? And look at evidence, right, that leaders may be providing to us of the ways in which they're kind of balancing short-term and long-term considerations without necessarily just relying on the decision that they ultimately make. But I would just say that I think your question is a huge one, right? That I'm not sure any of us have a great answer to, which is, you know, how do we, I think so many of the ways in which we as individuals and political leaders themselves, the ways that we accommodate ourselves to time and the way that we adjust what we're doing based on temporal considerations is almost so implicit and sort of so natural for many of us that it's hard to kind of pull it out and analyze it effectively and understand. And as you're saying, what is intentional that, and what are we doing kind of consciously, right? And what is it that is just sort of becomes part of our kind of instinctive ways of responding to things that we don't even think twice about, you know, okay, it's dark out, I'm going to start thinking about going to bed, right? And like, you know, it just, I think it's a really challenging question.
Thank you very much. And now, Professor Beasley, we'll go back to you. And Al, if it's all right to put you on the spot here, I'll add an extra kind of question on top of that, something that you mentioned earlier. You mentioned the idea of change continuum, which obviously Professor Holm has written about, and you operationalize in your own work on foreign policy decision making, changing this idea of time from linear to mapping these different changes that occur in society, in our own lives, against each other as a form of time. So if I could, not just is timing kind of active and intentional temporal decisions, but on top of that, to what degree does it feel like changing the idea of time to mapping different changes is kind of turtles all the way down? Because it feels like at any given point in our own lives, we're always mapping changes, that kind of everything that we do is really just mapping changes against each other. And so is all of that really kind of just functionally timing? And what role does that play kind of methodologically and empirically?
Thanks for the easy questions. One feature of time, when you think about it the way I described earlier, timing, is that sometimes it's active and conscious, and sometimes it's passive and non-conscious. Like Professor Edelstein said, we don't think much about it. Once it gets dark, at some point, we're going to think about going to bed. The circadian rhythms of our lives sort of are routinized, and we don't think much about it. You said we should gather at a certain point in time on the clock. I look at the clock. I don't have any questions about the notion that the clock is going to be something that is guiding my actions throughout the workday. So those are very passive and background and not very active ways of thinking about time. But at other moments, when things start to get out of sync, like the soundtrack and the video track, you know, once they start to disjoin a bit, there's a certain dissonance, a temporal dissonance that happens in people, and they become active and they say, I have to solve this problem. I have to do something about this because there's a slippage that's going on and things aren't lining up the way I want them to. And that's really the political side of foreign policy timing theory, is that actors will retime things on purpose to get a particular outcome. And that makes it political, but it also means that at certain points, it's a very conscious activity. Now, whether they would call it time, probably not. They wouldn't call it time, but I do, and we do. And in that sense, we can see them taking actions in a decision-making sense to try and alter certain change dynamics in the political world to their will. It can be a lot of different techniques and a different things, you know, like if you create an election day. So before election day, everybody's running around with random scattered preferences about this and that. But on election day, everybody gathers, organizes, and expresses their preference. And that coordinates all those preferences into a democratic outcome. So somebody generates election day. Election day is a timing standard that governs our behavior. So lots of things can be timing standards. And I don't mind that there are turtles all the way down. If you actually ask physicists, is there something really out there that is time? They'll kind of say, we don't really know for sure. I mean, we don't actually know. And so the fact that we're not yoking it to some real objective, constant, true thing is kind of irrelevant. I mean, the way I think of it is time is the greatest human invention, is something that we've constructed so that we can organize our lives better. Because it becomes so routine and so common, we think of it as objectively true, and therefore it's very passively guiding our lives. But at times in politics, it becomes more active. And so people consciously are trying to manipulate time in order to get what they want.
I do apologize for putting you both on the spot with that question. I know that is a difficult one that is kind of still being grappled with in time theory. And if we could, kind of, we'll shift focus a little bit here, although it'll adopt a similar track. It's focusing on the actual methodology of time. It feels like you mentioned this, Professor Beasley, in your commentary, where there are things that people don't really refer to as time, maybe explicitly, but there's definitely some sort of temporal aspect to it, some temporal dimension. I think if we talk about political time, maybe one of the first examples that comes to mind for those unfamiliar is debates over daylight savings time. This is the time of year when that usually happens, where people wonder, is it still relevant? Is it still useful? Do we still need it? And I think, I don't know if it was last year or the year before, when it actually went to Westminster for a vote about whether to keep daylight savings time or add an extra second to the clock, things like that. But it feels like in both of your work, there's much more nuanced operationalizations of time by political leadership, that it's not that they say time, they use other language that feels temporal. So how exactly do we know when language feels temporal, I guess is the question. When we go about kind of going through archives, reading primary source, using political statements, what does it sound like to actually use time? Professor Elstein, we'll start with you.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think precisely because time is often so implicit in everything we do, it's really hard to actually, like, you don't get many smoking guns, right? You don't get leaders talking about time explicitly because there's no reason to, right? It would seem kind of weird and obtuse to be talking about it kind of in a very explicit way. Instead, you know, what I found myself doing and continuing to do, right, is kind of reviewing documents, reviewing speeches, reviewing, you know, commentary, and drawing out from them, in this statement, right, they're not talking explicitly about time, but there's an implicit kind of temporal assumption that's built into it, right? Or in some way, it reflects a particular temporal view, right? So, you know, seeing a leader talking about doing X, Y, or Z may be an indication of their time horizon, even though they're not intending it to be an indication of their time horizon. But one, as an analyst, one can read it and say, well, we can infer from this, right, that they're thinking in a more long-term oriented way or a more short-term oriented way, right? So, you know, I think one has to be careful about that and make sure, you know, you go into documents, if you go into them looking for a certain thing, you tend to find that certain thing, right? And that's something that we all as social scientists need to be conscious of. But I think as long as you kind of do it with due care, there's actually a lot to be drawn out in this regard, right? And it's, again, one of the reasons why I think I became very interested in it, and I think others became very interested in it, is because once you sort of adopt this temporal frame on thinking about politics, you see it everywhere, right? And you see it in lots of the kind of conversations and discussions that leaders are having.
If I could follow up, I don't mean to spoil the book for the Over the Horizon for Read Leaders too much, but specifically in the context of great power politics and having, I think the comparison there is the US and China, and that's the discussion. So what does that look like for US political leadership or political leadership in China to use long-term or short-term rhetoric? What does that actually look like?
One of the big debates about China that I engage somewhat with in the book and some other things that I've written, right, is there is this argument out there that China has uniquely long time horizons, right? That they, bluntly, it's a kind of culturalist argument, right? That the Chinese for millennia have thought about things in terms of millennia, right? And they think in this very long-term oriented way that is kind of juxtaposed with, say, you know, the United States, which is thought to be very instinctive and impulsive, and, you know, its kind of democratic system exerts pressures on political leaders to act that way, right? And there are many who have said, well, you know, the implication of this is that China is kind of better prepared for sort of thinking about a kind of long-term competition with the United States than the US is. So I will say, and I'll immediately put this aside, I think this argument is hogwash, but leaving that aside, the way that you determine that it's hogwash, or the way that I suppose you make the case, right, is lots of people have been looking at, you know, what Chinese leaders say, what Chinese leaders write, and sort of trying to kind of discern from that certain kind of implications about Chinese time horizons. I will say those who have kind of advocating for the this kind of culturalist argument about the kind of long time horizons of China are, I think, making a very kind of superficial read of some of those documents, right? And I think our kind of closer inspection suggests that they don't really hold up in any way better than lots of other political rhetoric holds up, right? So, you know, for me, in looking at the kind of U.S.-China relationship, it's been a lot of reading kind of that material from Chinese leaders as well as American leaders thinking about this kind of this intersection. I'll just mention one other example, something I've been working on recently with some co-authors, is there seems to be this prevailing belief in both the United States and in China that in this competition, emerging competition between the two of them, that both sides tend to see time as on their side, right? That kind of they're going to sort of be, you know, over the medium term, they're going to fare better than the adversary, and they just kind of have to wait it out, right? And again, that relies on kind of not only taking an immediate glance at the rhetoric, but looking at some of the things that might be underlying the rhetoric and sort of trying to understand as truly reflective of their beliefs and what is more sort of instrumental rhetoric.
That's very helpful. Thank you. Yeah, that was one of the questions that I had, especially about timing theory. We'll move to you here, Professor Beasley, is the strategic impact that it feels like different ideas about time and its role actually make on the decisions of political leadership. Professor Beasley, in your article with Professor Hum on Brexit, the article starts with Big Ben just had to bong for Brexit. And I think that's a quote from a statement from the House of Commons. And I thought that was a really interesting operationalization of an explicit timing symbol and something like Big Ben that's that iconic and a cultural staple. So to pose the same question to you here, what's the kind of material impact? Is there strategic influence of timing symbols on the decisions of political leadership?
Yeah, I think that once you recognize or once you theorize time as being something about the effectiveness of coordinating things towards outcomes that you want, then you begin to see actors trying to attach symbols of success to good time. Things are going well. And you see them begin to use language that's much more disparaging and negative when things are not going the way they want them. They're mistimed or poorly timed. And so one of the implications of looking at things through timing theory is that actors will use time language differently depending on how they feel about the effectiveness of the way things are coordinated or the way things are synchronized or synthesized. So you'll see things like the Great Britain has, it's a great time ahead. Brexit portends a fantastic future. Time will be on our side, et cetera. And then the opponents use language that say the clock is running out, we're running out of time, we're feeling time pressure, time is doing things to us that we don't like. And that's part of the theory of timing theory, is that we actually change our vernacular. We actually change the types of things we refer to based on how we think time is going. So Big Ben just had to bong for Brexit was essentially Boris Johnson wanting to symbolize in a temporal way, the magnificence of the transformation of Brexit. They couldn't pull it off because it was being repaired then. And so they were unable to have Big Ben bong for Brexit. But you can see the symbolic nature of time in the thinking of the decision makers as they grappled with an important foreign policy question about the future direction of the UK and the world. So yes, I think measuring time in language is exactly as was described, difficult because we don't talk about time, but we do use time phrases and time terminology, and we use them differently depending on how we're orienting ourselves or feeling about time at a given moment.
And that's very helpful. Thank you. Yeah, this is very useful to get a sense of methodologically what it's actually look like to study something as complex and ubiquitous as time. This is the penultimate question before we kind of conclude here. One final question before the last question is just about the idea of things are not going well. So we've talked about the US and China maybe thinking that, you know, time is on our side more generally. We had the opportunity to host Professor Naomi Claire Lazar, who's done some work on political legitimacy crises and where time becomes a tool to regain some legitimacy that might otherwise be brought into question. So I wonder, does it actually look like for time to no longer be on your side? How does that sound for political leadership? And are there any strategic changes that brings about? So for Professor Beasley, this might be, you mentioned malcontents in the political leadership in Westminster. And Professor Edelstein, I wonder, in the US-China debate, are there any voices that kind of use time as a tool to regain any lost legitimacy in that conflict? We'll start here, Professor Beasley.
Well, I mean, it's a good question. I think we see that time is something that is sort of weaponized in political discourses. Often you'll see actors talking about the future, the brightness of the future. Future-oriented language is often very positive, positively framed by those who are in power. We're going great places, things will be getting better, et cetera. But you'll often hear opponents using language that talks about the negative outcomes that we can see or the temporal consequences of decisions today that will last for far into the future. See this in politics all the time, that it is temporalized combat. Time is weaponized. And it was something that we mentioned, the Brexit case. Many of the people involved in that debate, in those policymaking processes, actually referred to the weaponization of time. Well, you've got a deadline. Here's a deadline, and you're using this deadline to force us to do something prematurely that we don't want to do. I don't know if that exactly answers your question. I think time is one of those resources that people can contest. It's contestable. Time is contestable. And therefore, it is something that becomes the object of political discourse, or it becomes embedded in political discourses. You see it, well, right now in the United States, you have the, not in foreign policy or international relations, but, you know, the Roe versus Wade decision and the potential of it being overturned. And the language of time is all over this. It will be changed. A historic precedent was being used from the 1300s to overturn a law that will last far into the future. This is the time language of those who are opposed to this type of transformation. I think it's temporality is a fundamental feature of political combat. It's not time per se, but it is the nature of the longevity of the historical precedents and the future consequences. We see it also in climate change. This is a huge area where time is a big factor in the discussion about it. We have to change things immediately or we will live with the consequences forever. These are temporal phrases that are used as sort of the political fodder, if you will, in political debates.
So that does answer my question. Thank you. Something you mentioned there before we move to Professor Edelstein here is if time is always in contest effectively, and that's really the fundamental of political debates and discourse, it feels like then at all chronological times, it's heterotemporal. That at any given point in time, there's different ideas of temporality that are constantly at play. So if we could turn to Professor Edelstein, especially when you're conducting the more kind of positivist project about tracking the influence of time on decisions and the kind of explanatory force that time and temporality will have, how do you come to terms with, well, first, are there any examples where it felt like within any given kind of example of US leadership employing maybe long-term horizons or short-term horizons, at any given time, there's multiple different ideas of temporality that are all being deployed at once within some broader structure? And then on top of that, in a positivist project like yours, how do you come to terms with that?
Yeah, so I don't know that I'd go as far as saying sort of multiple notions of temporality, right? But I would say multiple contesting kind of understandings of temporal situation, right? Or the, you know, so just to give the example on the kind of US-China case, right? So there's an argument that is reasonably popular these days in Washington, you know, in the debates over US policy towards China, an argument that's been made by Mike Beckley and Hal Brands that are basically suggesting that China's already peaked, that Chinese power has kind of reached its apex. and that, you know, the United States is in a position now of thinking about kind of for the next decade or so, a kind of China that's in decline, right? And so, and then the strategic implications of that, all right, well, how does one think about interacting with China if that is in fact the kind of the prognosis for the next decade, right? There is another kind of camp of people looking at this U.S.-China relationship who disagree with that, right? And who think that China has not necessarily peaked, that, you know, especially if you think about things in kind of relative power dynamics, that you know, the U.S., there's kind of reasons for skepticism about kind of U.S. power and capabilities relative to Chinese power and capabilities, right? And sort of understood through that lens, the next decade looks a lot different, right? And sort of how to think about and understand this next decade and how to kind of think about the strategic implications of that next decade, right? Of that time going forward. And so I wouldn't necessarily think of it as kind of alternative notions of temporality, right? As much as kind of alternative interpretations of what a particular time frame is likely to be. One other thing I wanted to mention that your question kind of provoked for me, right, is, you know, we think about, there are various, I guess, aphorisms about time, right, or kind of phrases that invoke time, right? So time is on your side, right, is one of them. I think another one that is pertinent to bring up and is, I think, sometimes a kind of goes to your question about kind of legitimacy and rebuilding legitimacy, right, is a strategy we talk about of buying time, right, which, you know, like think about that phrase for a moment and all the questions of how we think about time and conceive of time, right? What does it actually mean to buy time, right? As if it's a commodity that one could go out to the store and get. Now, of course, that's not the case, right? But the strategies that actors use to buy time, right? To kind of put off a critical moment until later, right? I think are actually also critically important in international politics and worth thinking about as a political strategy more generally to say, okay, I'm short on legitimacy at the moment. Is there a way that I can buy time and in order to rebuild that legitimacy before some critical moment arrives?
Thank you both. And another phrase that kind of came to mind as you were discussing kind of buying time is the idea of time running out.
Yeah.
I think this was employed a lot, it felt, by the Trump administration, saying that the conflict is, it's at its peak. We're about to get there, to we're running out of time. Or in the case of the Brexit leadership, where the Conservative Party effectively was pushing the fact that we need a deal now. So I thought that was another kind of phrase that came to mind there. If we could conclude on this last question, this is not necessarily kind of a substantive question, but more to give the listeners an idea of what happens next. So where exactly does all of this leave the analyst? Where does IR scholarship go from here, temporal or otherwise? And what other interesting questions are there left to explore, whether within the kind of niche of temporal IR or elsewhere? And at this point, you can also go ahead. I think this would be a good opportunity to discuss any recent work, current projects, or any questions that you might be interested in exploring in your own research moving forward. We'll start here with Professor Beasley.
Yeah, I think we've barely begun to scratch the surface of the applications and investigations we can do looking at time, whether that's more traditional conceptions of time or whether that's some of the critical scholars who are working on time. I think it's been something we've seen a temporal turn, if you will, in IR. But for example, my subfield of foreign policy, when I took a look at it, it's got time everywhere and nobody's theorized it. So all of the types of models and frameworks that we have out there could do with an additional pass thinking about what is the role of time and are we thinking of time in the same way when we're modeling different aspects of decision-making in foreign policy? If you look at bureaucracies and you're doing a bureaucratic politics approach to understanding foreign policy making, we all know bureaucracies function at a slower pace. We all know that time works differently in bureaucracies as compared to crisis decision-making. So maybe we've got different models that are in part drawing upon different conceptions of time, but we haven't really examined time in a very theoretical way. So almost everything that has the phrase over time, something, something over time, is a ripe area for us to investigate. What exactly do we mean by over time? And is it the same thing in each of these different accounts as we as scholars put that forward? My interest is kind of goes back. The first thing that I'm interested in is doing some more applications of timing theory. So I'm currently working with a scholar, Amine Mavar, and we're applying timing theory to the Iran nuclear question. And if you take a look at that case, It's got Time's signature all over it. How fast can Iran develop a nuclear weapon in the negotiations to try and constrain that? They came up with a concept called breakout time. That's how fast can they get usable uranium? And they use that as a clock to time sanctions against Iranian behavior. And so we're writing up this case to apply again beyond Brexit to other foreign policy cases. The main area that I'll be working on over the coming months is looking at individual differences in temporal orientations. So we have a lot of work in foreign policy decision-making that looks at leaders' personalities and tries to map characteristics of leaders to the types of behaviors they engage in foreign policy. And we do that using at-a-distance measures. We look at the speeches they make and we infer characteristics of their personality from the types of language that they use. And so I'm going to be trying to develop a measure of temporal orientation that distinguishes different leaders. Some are very temporally sensitive, temporally aware, future-oriented, et cetera, while others differ. And that is going to require me doing some of the things that Professor Edelstein was talking about, coming up with a set of words and phrases that signify differences in temporal orientation. And I think it would be valuable for us because time is so pervasive in politics, but we don't have anything that really measures it based on the way leaders orient themselves to time. And so I would like to make sort of an empirical contribution by coming up with some substantive measures that can be applied to leaders that might give us insights into their temporal behaviors.
That would be fascinating. Very much looking forward to that. Professor Edelstein, the same to you. Where do we go from here?
I think, you know, in general, where we go from here, right, is I think the temporal turn is still relatively young, right? And I think we maybe start thinking about it kind of moving into adolescence, right? What to me that implies is sort of starting to think about a kind of a theoretical maturity, right? And that we've had to kind of people coming at these questions from different theoretical perspectives. Are there potential opportunities there to kind of bring together some of these kind of theoretical approaches and generate something even more interesting and novel and kind of this next kind of theoretical stage of development? I also think empirically, there's a lot of work to be done, not only in refining the methods that we're using to study these things, but also then applying those methods in kind of different empirical domains, right? So, for example, I think there are a whole host of interesting questions to be asked in the kind of international political economy domain about some of these questions, right? Whether it has to do with the kind of changing dynamics of economic interdependence, whether it has to do with economic sanctions, right? Just a whole variety of kind of empirical questions there that could be asked that would be really interesting. For me personally, I'll say that I've been collecting a lot of notes and becoming very interested in questions coming out of the tragedy of the war in Ukraine about the various temporal dimensions of war itself and how we see those playing out, right? So everything from, you know, expectations of a short war that some had at the outset to, you know, I was just reading this morning about testimony by the U.S. Director of National Intelligence before Congress about how Putin is in this for the long term, right? For a long war, and thinking about the various ways in which all of these kind of temporal dimensions kind of impact the way that we think about war, the way that war is conducted, and what we might be able to learn about war through that. So, not at all to belittle any of the human tragedy in Ukraine, but, you know, as scholars in international politics, I think sometimes it's our obligation to recognize some of the interesting questions that come out of conflicts like this.
So I think it would be really interesting to see how, obviously, war is kind of the age-old puzzle in politics. So I think it'd be really interesting to see how the new temporal turn might shed some new insight and light on that. So thank you very much. That effectively concludes the conversation. So thank you very much to our listeners. Thank you to our guests, Professor Beasley and Professor Edelstein, for joining me. This has been A Greater European Talks, and I'm Aditya Srinivasan.